Officially welcome everyone to today's Internet Seminar. My name is Jean Balance, and I'm coming to you from EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as one of your session moderators. In just a moment, I'll turn things over to Michelle Mahoney from the same office, who will actually be guiding you through today's presentation, along with our primary speaker. But before that, I'm going to cover a few basic housekeeping items and reminders for our Managing Contaminants in Urban Vegetable Gardens to Minimize Human Exposure Internet Seminar. Today's session has been sponsored by the U.S. EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division and is scheduled to run from approximately 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern. For those of you that may be new to our Clue In webinars, when you signed up, you should have received an email registration confirmation, but you'll also have an email reminder in your inbox that does have a complete set of instructions for today's live broadcast. That email will ultimately point you to something known as the seminar homepage, which will live in perpetuity from this point forward. On that homepage, you can read more about the broadcast. You'll find contact information for our presenters and moderators. There are links to download the slides as well as other resources and items that will be discussed today. For now, though, you'll want to click a button that appears in the upper left corner of that page labeled Go to Seminar. Once you click that button, you'll be asked to identify yourself by name, as well as the number of people at your location, and then you should be successfully checked in online to our live broadcast that's being offered through Adobe Connect. If you have any technical problems with that process of checking in, you can download the slides and simply follow along on the phone lines, but we do encourage you to let us know so we can troubleshoot those issues and get you on board for the fully interactive session. Audio will be available online by default. That means all participants can actually listen to the broadcast online through their computer speakers or with a pair of headphones. If that has problems, go ahead and check your local volume controls first. Sometimes people simply need to increase their speaker output. But if that doesn't solve the problem, we do have toll-free call-in information. So you can request that call-in number at any time using the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. Just know if you join us on the phone lines, you will be globally muted, and we ask that you remain on that global mute to minimize background noises and other audio disruptions. We will take a break for Q&A, and at that point, our moderator will actually start reading through questions out loud so that our presenter can answer them. But there's no need to wait for that designated Q&A break. In fact, you can submit your comments and questions as well as to report technical problems at any time using our private Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. To submit a comment or question, simply click on the empty box at the bottom of the Q&A window, type it up, and then either hit enter on your keyboard or press the cartoon bubble button that appears to the right, and that'll privately submit your message in. Today's session is being recorded and will automatically be archived on the Clue In podcast and archive page. You should receive an automated email as soon as that session is available to replay and download. And if you can't wait, you can now go to the archive page on Clue In and browse the nearly 600 previously recorded Internet seminars that we have posted. Again, just a gentle reminder, you will see a screen something like this. You'll see the PowerPoint presentations appear here on the left. Our speakers will control movement through the slides. If you need to, there's a button in the upper right. It looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions. If you click that button once, it'll make the slides bigger. Click it a second time, it'll shrink them back down. You can feel free to zoom in or expand them as needed for your viewing experience. And then our Clue In logo should appear in the upper right corner. We have a collection of related URLs in the middle right. Those are all active hyperlinks. You can click on those at any time and then press the Browse To button to open them up locally. And then, of course, as mentioned, the Q&A window here in the lower right, you can type up your comments and questions here and either hit Enter or press the cartoon bubble button to the right to submit them in. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to your primary session moderator, who's also joining me here from the Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. Michelle Mahoney. Michelle, whenever you're ready, please take it away.
Great. Thank you, Jean, for the introduction. Before we get started today, I just wanted to let everyone know that we at EPA on our cluein.org webpage have a focus area called EcoTools, where we post tools for ecological land reuse. And on that page, we have an area that focuses on growing gardens and urban soils, and we post information related to potential contamination and gardening. We have a fact sheet, we have archives to webinars, we have some podcasts and links to the Brownfields program, Superfund program, and everything that you could possibly need to learn about cleaning up a site so that you can potentially garden in there, in an area where you suspect there may be contamination from the prior use of the site. So I just wanted to make sure everyone was aware of this website. Check it out, and if you have any questions or can't find something you're looking for, You can get in touch with me. My contact information is on the main seminar page for this webinar. And with that, I'm going to introduce our speaker for today. We are very lucky to have Ganga Hetarachi, who is an associate professor from the Soil and Environmental Chemistry Department of Agronomy at Kansas State. And currently, Ganga leads research on providing training and technical assistance for gardening initiatives at brownfield sites. And so she's very knowledgeable in the subject matter. Ganga is going to deliver three topical presentations for us today. She's going to talk about common contaminants and human exposure risks of urban gardening, using soil amendments to reduce human exposure to contaminants, and then gardening at brownfield sites. In between each of these three topics, we're going to pause for questions. So as Jean mentioned, we definitely encourage you to submit your questions as you think of them so that when we get to the break for the questions, we're ready to go and having a conversation with Ganga. So with that, Ganga, we're very excited to hear your talk. So it's all yours.
Thank you, Michelle. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Michelle, can you hear me?
You sound good. You could be a little louder.
Okay. Okay, I'll try to be...
That sounds great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to move to first section of my today's presentation. Okay. And common contaminants and human exposure risk of urban gardening. I'm going to start with showing this picture, depicting some major soil quality issues in the urban soils. Before we get into this soil quality issues, I would like to define soil quality. Soil quality is defined by Soil Science Society of America as the capacity of a soil to function within a natural low managed ecosystem boundaries. So most urban soils, when we look at that, have only very shallow A horizon. Mm-hmm. So that's a big issue. And then in most cases, we can see very little of B horizon or absence of B horizon. And then C horizon is definitely highly impacted by human activities. So let's look at what are the major soil quality issues in urban soils. So as you can see, the common soil quality issues in urban soils, soil compaction is one of the major ones. And that is something we have commonly observed in many urban sites we worked on. And then shallow soil and presence of a lot of stones and other debris, that's another issue in most of these urban sites. Poor drainage, it has relationship to soil compaction as well. And poor drainage or lack of drainage is another major one. The most urban soils are very low in organic matter, so that very low in nutrient concentration. And because of previous impact or because of ongoing anthropogenic activities, we can see interrupted nutrient cycling, modified organism activity. And as a consequence of these things, you could see poor nutrient availability. And those are, in addition to that, the soil contamination, which is going to be focus of today's talk. So the soil contamination due to just the location of these sites, previous usage of these sites, such as even buildings, or industrial activities. So fallout due to industrial activities, those are the reasons for contamination. With that, I would like to move on to next slide, showing the contaminants in urban soils. So when we are trying to grow vegetables for consumption, one of the major challenges of growing vegetables in an urban environment is the possibility of soil contamination. So example, these possibilities are lead from paint and leaded gasoline, arsenic and DDT and chlorine as pesticides, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons from incomplete burning or carbon-containing materials. So these are the things that commonly you could find. And then depending on site you are looking at, there can be some other contaminants as well. So if we look at potential exposure pathways of these soil contaminants in urban gardens, we can categorize these pathways first into two major categories, direct exposure pathways and indirect exposure pathways. Direct exposure pathways examples are ingestion of soil and dust, that is direct soil to human directly. And there are other potential direct exposure pathways, inhalation and dermal exposure. These pathways compared to ingestion appear to be very insignificant in most cases. And then the indirect, indirect exposure pathways, the most concerned indirect exposure pathway is soil to plant to human. But when we look at research data, research indicates that the potential exposure pathways of concern is direct exposure of human to contaminated soils. And the pathway from contaminated soil to plant to human is insignificant. That appears to be very low. So this actually take us to defining another term that I'm going to use in this section, that is bioavailability. As you can see that different organizations and different scientists, this is a soil scientist, Fosito, 1989. So there are various definitions for this term bioavailability. The term bioavailability can be simply defined as the fraction of the substance or substances of concern in soil that is available for absorption by human or plants. So the bioavailability, so this one, I'm going to use this to actually describe the concept of bioavailability in soil a little bit further. So this one, this particular figure is from Pearson Scatal 2005. And the first point, the two different contaminants can have different bioavailabilities in the same soil, as you can see in this example dealing with plant uptake. So the same level of soil cadmium and lead, and bioavailability, if you look at the bioavailability and as a consequence, it can result different plant tissue concentrations. So this shows that bioavailability of cadmium to plant is much greater than bioavailability of lead to plant. So resulting more cadmium in plant tissues compared to lead in tissues. So the next point is the same contaminant can have different bioavailabilities in two different soils. So if you look at this second example on the right-hand side, that is dealing with human uptake. In this case, assume ingestion of same amount of soil produce, you could see differing effect, indicating that bioavailability of lead in soil B is greater than bioavailability of lead in soil A to human chia. So If we look at bioavailability of soil contaminants, the bioavailability of soil contaminants depends on the solubility and availability of different pools of contaminants in soil and soil properties. Bottom line is, most anything in soil will not be 100% bioavailable. Let's look at some things in affecting bioavailability. Speciation. It is important to know what the chemistry or the speciation of contaminant in soil. Here I do have lead as an example in this figure. So if we look at what are the forms of lead in soil, we could have free lead in soil solution as free metal, so as lead 2+, lead ion. And then at the same time, we could have lead in soil solution as soluble complexes of lead, complexes to inorganic ligands as well as organic ligands. We can have polymeric organic complexes that lead actually associated with organic matter. We can also have adsorbo incorporated metal onto soil minerals. So examples are lead bound or in microparticulate of oxide or aluminosilicate. At the same time, we can have precipitated metal formed depending on concentration of that particular metal in soil. The examples for lead, lead phosphate, lead carbonate, lead sulfate, lead sulfide, etc. So if we look at these solution species and what's in solid, so we will be moving from, as you move from solution to solid with high availability to low availability. So speciation, understanding speciation is very important. Even if you look at, even if you have different precipitated forms of lead, those could have very differing solubility. So the next thing is soil properties that I'm going to first focus on pH. So undoubtedly, pH has great influence on contaminant bioavailability. So here in this soil, same soil adjusted to same contaminated soil adjusted to differing pH by adding lime. So the first, the second, third, and fourth column is dealing with cadmium, copper, and nickel. And what do we know about cadmium, copper, and nickel? They do exist in soil solution mainly as cationic metals. So the contaminants that do exist in soil solution as cationic metals, they share common characteristic, that is, their bioavailability will decrease with increasing pH. So as you can see here, when we are increasing soil pH from 6 to 7 to 7.7, you can see that the concentration of copper, cadmium, nickel in alfalfa tissue decreases. So the next one is molybdenum, that's the last column. The molybdenum do exist in soil solution as an oxyanion, that same as arsenic or selenium. In general, oxyanion bioavailability increase with increasing pH. Here it is evidenced by enhanced molybdenum concentration in alfalfa due to increasing pH. So soil type, that can have great influence on bioavailability as well. I'm using this example. This example is showing the zinc contaminated soil with like one is clay soil, that's the top portion, and the second one is similar levels of zinc with sand, in sand. So if you look at the clay soil versus sand, and in clay soil, zinc concentration up to about 300 to 450 ppm or milligrams per kilogram. No significant effect on plant growth in this soil. The zinc is known to be phytotoxic, so zinc is also a micronutrient, so we plant do need it, and plant do respond to it, so that's what we see in initial parts, three parts, and then but when it is exceeding certain level, it can be phytotoxic. That is what we are observing in the fourth, fifth, and sixth parts. So in sand, when we look at levels of zinc actually causing the significant phytotoxicity to suppress the nearly 90% of growth, you can see that the level of zinc can be as low as 75 ppm. In this case, at 75 ppm, you can see that growth of this plant is significantly impacted. So this shows us that the same contaminant, the same level, but depending on soil type, you could see different response. That is because bioavailability of zinc in clay soil, because of high resorbing soil capacity, it is significantly higher than bioavailability of zinc in the sandy soil. So the next one is showing another concept that mostly calling as natural attenuation, sequestration, as well as sometimes we refer to as aging effect in soil. First section shows field transect of copper contamination, and we can see significant effect of elevated copper concentration in soil until concentration reach around 828 ppm or milligrams per kilogram. If we look at the control soil from the same area, spike with copper soil to achieve varying levels of total copper in soil, similar to this field transect. And looking at root elongation, you can clearly see that root elongation is minimal at copper concentration of about 191 ppm. So it clearly showing aging effect, field transect or field contaminated versus fresh spike with a copper salt. So in addition to that, we all know and observe that the species difference in tolerance or the uptake to soil contaminants. So here this is showing that the different uptake patterns, different effect of metal contamination on rice, barley, and mustard, to point out the species difference in or tolerance for uptake. So this leads to the point that I want to make here during this presentation, that the addition of soil amendments can reduce contaminant bioavailability. So this example is showing four pots and filled with same contaminated soil and use different soil amendments. As you can see, that effects are different. First pot show non-amended metal contaminated soils. The metals here are zinc and copper, both known to cause phytotoxicity. Second one is amended with lime to increase pH. So we can see that by increasing pH, we can reduce the phytotoxic effect of these two metals. The third and fourth one actually amended with two different industrial byproducts rich in the contaminant, the material capable of absorbing these contaminants. First one with beringite, that's a modified aluminosilicate known to have good soaking capacity, and then the second one with red mud, rich in iron oxide residues. So as you can see that different soil amendment causing different effects because they are changing bioavailability of copper and zinc in this soil and affecting it differently. So this figure shows IEUBK model output, and IEUBK stands for Integrated Exposure Uptake Biokinetic Model. And this is showing the influence of soil-led bioavailability on the proportion of children 6 to 72 months age who have blood lead concentration greater than 10 micrograms per deciliter. So curve one, this model run was performed assuming 800 ppm of soil lead and 30 ppm of bioavailability. The curve two assumed 30% bioavailability. So as you can see in curve two that we cannot exceed 375 ppm of lead to have no more than 5% of the children in this community with greater than 10 micrograms per deciliter blood lead concentration. So until 2012, CDC used 10 micrograms per deciliter as the reference level, and it has changed in 2012 from 10 to 5, but these models were ran before. So if we look at curve 3, the same type of reduction we can achieve by reducing bioavailability. So the second one, reducing total concentration. Third one, we keep the total concentration as it is and reduce the bioavailability. And then we can see that we can achieve the same outcome. With that, I'm going to open this section for questions and discussion.
Okay, excellent. Just a brief reminder, if you are participating, listening to the audio online, you can type up your questions electronically in the Q&A window in the lower right corner. For those of you joining on the phone lines, again, we do have everyone on a global mute, and we would encourage you to also submit your questions electronically in the Q&A window. Let's see, Michelle Mahoney, are you with us on the line and prepared to start going through some of the questions?
Yes, thank you, Jean. Okay, we do have a couple questions that have come in while you were speaking, Ganga, so I guess we'll go through those, and if more come in, we'll take the time to address those. We had a question from an extension educator in the city of Philadelphia, and I know you addressed this a little bit in your talk, but she essentially wants to know, you know, if you're an educator and you're trying to let your community know about potential contaminants in your city, in this case Philadelphia, what you should test for, what would you tell them? And I guess she's asking because right now they only generally suggest to test for lead, but there is some concern that that may be insufficient given the amount of dumping and other history of uses in some of these sites. Do you have any advice for someone in that situation?
Yeah, I think I'm going to address that in later sections that to answer to this particular question. And it is very hard to really say these need to be included, but can include, in addition to lead, can include arsenic, cadmium, because they are pretty common as well, but not as common as lead. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, there can be contaminants, like suite of contaminants. It is very hard to say that these are the things that you need to look for. Only thing we do know that the common organic contaminants are like polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon. We came across with the site contaminated with that. And these tests are expensive, so my advice would be actually looking into site history as much as one can, and then depending on that site history, actually decide what to test for.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's a good point.
Tests can be really expensive. And what we are actually advising too is just like do a common metal panel, including lead, cadmium, arsenic, metal and metalloids mm-hmm. panel, including lead, arsenic, and cadmium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's good advice. And I, you know, from our perspective at EPA, we, you know, we try to educate people that you kind of need to know what the history was of the site to be able to identify, you know, what other contaminants may be of concern. So I think that's good advice, and I know that you'll be addressing this more further in your talk. We have a participant who submitted a question early on, and in the beginning of your presentation, you provided a definition of soil. Do you think you could repeat that for the audience?
You mean definition of soil quality?
Yeah. You were giving some definitions as an introduction, and I guess someone maybe didn't
soil
get
quality,
all of it.
I was using the definition given by Soil Science Society of America, that the capacity of a soil to function within natural low managed ecosystem boundaries. So basically, the provide the ecosystem services. So the mm-hmm. soil's ability to function within its natural low managed ecosystem boundaries. So that's the mm-hmm. definition we have for soil quality.
Okay, and great. We have another person, and they want to know if you've looked at bioavailability of contaminants to plants from contaminated groundwater. I guess
we
the concern would be if you're...
not any research related to that. But I do have not directly contaminated groundwater, but the communities impacted by contaminated groundwater, and then looking at, if you think about contaminated groundwater and vegetable gardening, the root depth is so low, so you would not expect that vegetables to be, and then the growing period is very low too, short. So you would not expect vegetables to be affected that much. And the things you can look at is fruiting crops and things like that. I do have a slide actually sharing some research data related to TCE uptake.
Okay. Okay, great. Let's see. I guess another person is curious, what are the effects of arsenic concentration on plant growth?
We have not seen, we had some contaminated soils we dealt with greater than arsenic, total arsenic concentration in soil greater than 100 milligrams per kilogram. And we have not seen any effect of arsenic concentration on plant growth. And the arsenic uptake seemed to be, especially, surface soils, well-aerated garden soils, seems to be very insignificant. Again, I will be sharing those research data.
Okay, sure. Why don't we take one more question, and then we'll let you continue on with your presentation. I know there's a number of questions coming in, but some of those may get addressed, you know, in your subsequent talk. But this one last question we'll take is, have you looked at the impact of soil vapor on gardens, on gardening? Emissions from
not specifically.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, good. And I appreciate everyone submitting these questions. It provides a great conversation with Ganga. But I think we'll move on to your second presentation, and then we'll pause again for questions that come in.
Okay. Thanks, Michelle. And the second part that I'm going to focus on using soil amendments to reduce human exposure to contaminants. So when you're thinking of gardening, from the questions we actually heard during that discussion period too, what are the questions that we need to consider? So is there contamination? And if there's contamination, what is it and how much? So, and then it is very important to know that what is and how much, because depending on contaminant, the level we need to be concerned can be different. And then sometimes the levels can be so high that you would not really consider gardening. And so that the next question would be that does the site require environmental cleanup? So if a site requires environmental cleanup, then we need to they need to find the way to deal with that one. And then if the contamination is mild to moderate and gardening is possible, then the next question would be that growing in ground or above ground, because the level of comfortability, like some may feel that comfortable of growing in ground, knowing science and the trusting science and feeling comfortable. And some people may not be comfortable knowing that there's elevated levels of lead or elevated levels of pHs or elevated levels of arsenic. So they might be a little bit thinking of whether going to in-ground or above ground. So using the raised beds or container gardening or things like that. So the next question, when you are deciding that, the who will work in the garden, whether it is adults, kids, or an ADA, so likewise. So in some cases for adults, if it is adults and especially ADA, then maybe that not only using raised beds, but kind of like deep raised bed might be a choice. And if it is something kids involved, then that is again something that we do need to specifically pay attention to. What is the contaminant, what is the level of contaminant, and what are the things we need to do. So the next question would be, another question would be that what are the general soil conditions? So like I mentioned in my first presentation, that soil contamination is not the only issue in these urban soils. You can have soil compaction, you can have poor nutrient availability, so you can have so many other issues, so that you basically need to not only test for contaminants, you need to test for agronomic parameters. Because if you are going to garden, you need to make sure that soil is in good quality, soil is loose, fibre, and has good nutrients and all that. Because when you provide those things, the stress to plants will be much less. And then the research has shown that under optimal conditions, actually plants can kind of ignore uptake of contaminants. So it's important to know general soil conditions and make sure that we take actions to improve that. And then the next one would be what crops will be grown. And you will understand by the end of this presentation, depending on the situation we are dealing with, we can actually decide what crops we are going to grow and what crops that we are not going to grow. So it's so those are the questions. So the growing in ground versus above ground, like I mentioned before, in brief, those are the decision-making drivers. For those would be liability. If you are growing for not consumption, not only for your consumption, but to share those, then there can be liability issues. And then the comfort level of gardeners regarding residual contamination. So like I mentioned, this could be different for different people. And then the soil conditions, accessibility, cost, space, all that comes into play when we are in decision-making process. If we are going to grow in situ, we may need to take some precautions, such as doing soil testing and finding what is not only contaminant level, but finding what the other soil parameters, and like I showed before, considering adding appropriate soil amendments to reduce bioavailability. So that would be something that can be easily done. And when I'm sharing research data, you will see that most of these soil amendments that are going to help to reduce bioavailability are things that gardeners usually use. So those are not completely strange things that we need to add. So here, so if it is not in ground, then the raised beds. So the raised bed depth could be about 6 to 8 inches, or in some cases, like I said, it could be deeper, depending on who will be gardening in that site. And this is showing container gardens, and I'm certain, and we actually dealt with some sites that gardeners did container gardening, although we did in-ground gardening to look at uptake. So the dealing with soil quality issues in urban soil would be next thing, that the soil pH, and then looking at soil type, clay versus sandy soil. So the nutrient status, whether in most cases it is inadequate in urban soils, and then the next one is soil pH. So the soil pH can be high or low, so need to deal with it depending on what we are going to garden. And then the looking at organic matter content, mostly in urban soils you will find the organic matter content is low. And then look at soil type, whether we are dealing with clay versus sandy soil. And then the soil compaction, whether we have soil compaction issues or not. And then the soil chemistry. So the soil chemistry, when we are looking at these chemical properties, so the concentration of soil contaminants, so that can have the toxicity effect. Some metals can be phytotoxic, so looking at those and dealing with those. And then the excess sodium that is common in urban soils, the excess sodium can be phytotoxic. Excess salt can be phytotoxic as well. So those are some of the soil quality issues that gardeners need to deal with, and soil amendments going to help. So this is actually our picture from our first site in Kansas City, Missouri, and the clay content was about 21%. So you can see that the soil compaction, cracking due to high clay, and then the various type of things you can find, the rocks, and the stones, and the glass chips, and things like that. So these are common, and this one is from the Tacoma, Washington site. Again, showing this soil was very poor, very sandy soil, and you would not really call it as soil, that it was that poor. And then there was so many rocks and stones that we had to remove when we were establishing our test plot. So what are the issues with compaction? So the compaction that reduces soil porosity. So porosity is important for air movement and root penetration. So the air movement and root penetration will be restricted. And then the poor porosity can lead to water runoff or ponds instead of infiltering. And then roots can grow sideways instead of downward root growing. So we do need to remediate, we need to find a remedy for this, and tilling and adding of compost for many, several different seasons would be what needed. So remember that the adding soil organic matter to improve soil quality issue that we are having, lack of porosity and soil compaction, it will also help to bind some contaminants, because when you keep on adding compost to soil, you will actually improve soil organic carbon pool, and then soil organic carbon or soil organic matter, especially stable organic matter, will bind contaminants both inorganic and organic and reduce their bioavailability. So that would be an added advantage that you would be getting when you are addressing compaction issue. So the soil nutrient status, like I said, we need to make sure that the nutrient the availability optimal, because when plants suffering from nutrient deficiencies, you would observe sometimes plants tend to take up more contaminants than they are under normal conditions. So the three main ones are listed here, but as you know that we do need to look at micronutrient availability as well. So the nitrogen is needed for healthy leaf and stem growth. You all know that most urban soils as well as other soils, the something you could see is low available nitrogen, so adding soil nitrogen to get these. The soil phosphorus levels, the important for root growth, flower production. And then the other, one other thing we know, and which has shown, that the phosphorus level can help to bind metals as well. So the phosphorus tend to bind, especially lead, and reduces lead bioavailability. So when you are taking care of making sure that the soil phosphorus levels are okay, then at the same time you are achieving, or unknowingly, you are reducing bioavailability of lead if you do have lead contamination in that soil. Potassium is next major nutrient that is going to help overall plant health. So the so if you have need, depending on need, soil testing laboratories usually tell whether you need to add fertilizers or not, then you can decide whether you are going to add inorganic or organic fertilizers. So the next soil property is soil pH. So soil pH, as you know, measure of soil acidity or basicity or the alkalinity. So this can have a greater, this can have great impact on numerous soil chemical reactions. So a little bit about, I know that you all are familiar with typical pH values that that can go from something close to 0 and 14, but even if you look at extreme range in pH for most mineral soils, it is not going to be I mean, as low, it can be as low as 3. I mean, it rarely be as low as that, and can as high as 10 or little over that. That is extreme range. Mostly, in most soils, you would see little narrow range that, this extreme range. So the, like I said, the soil pH has great impact on numerous soil chemical reactions and thereby affecting bioavailability. So the example is the soap tube capacity of soil is going to be dependent on soil pH. So the sorption can be adsorption or precipitation. So the if you take adsorption, the low soil pH means that the less adsorption of cationic metal, as I showed before, so you could see higher mobility of cationic metal or enhanced mobility of cationic metal under low pH condition. So the amending soil to bring pH up would help to deal with those cationic metal contamination or lower bioavailability of cationic metal contamination. And then on the other hand, the low pH would mean that lower mobility of anions. So the contaminants existing in soil solution as oxyanions or anions, you would see that lowering pH, you may see lower the mobility of those. So pH can be adjusted, adding lime, adding lime to increase alkalinity, so that's one way. And then if we want to, then the liming material, as you know that there are so many liming materials, so I'm not going to get into that. And then if we want to make soil a little acidic or increase the acidity, that can be common in some urban environments. So if that's the case, one way to do that would be that choosing some fertilizers that actually resulting soil acidity or increasing acidity. So for example, if you apply nitrogen as ammonium nitrate or ammonium sulfate, so this ammonium in these fertilizers would go through the nitrification, and then as a nitrification process, you would see that the protons will be released and soil will be acidified. So you could select some fertilizers that have acidulating effect. So that's one way. Another way to deal with that will be add elements of sulfur, aluminum sulfate to acidify soil. So reactions are shown there, although I'm not going to go into details unless you have specific questions. And then the organic matter content, and looking at organic matter content in urban soils and try to use soil amendments to improve that, can have great impact. So I know that all of you know that what's going to be the benefits of addition of organic matter or maintaining good organic matter content in soil. Organic matter enhances soil color, and it's not only pretty, but also it can have impact on soil temperature. So you can have really impact from that. And the organic matter improves soil structure, improve soil aggregation, thereby improving soil structure, improve soil drainage and aeration, so clay soils. I gave you that example already. And the enhancing or adding organic matter, you could enhance the water holding capacity of soil. So sandy soils would really benefit from adding organic matter. Organic matter would provide nutrients, so in addition to providing all those things, so the added organic matter itself can have available nutrient at that point, or they could actually go through mineralization process and release nutrients slowly. So that is also advantage over using fertilizer versus organic matter, because slow releasing of nutrients, especially some organic matter. And then organic matter, they're providing carbon and nutrients, so encourage microbial activity. So that is important. So this enhanced microbial activity can have so many positive effects on soil processes. And then the other thing is, when you keep on adding organic matter to enrich soil organic carbon fraction or the soil organic carbon content, you would see that the soil is capable of binding more contaminants and reducing bioavailability doing so. So the ideal organic matter content actually depends on soil type, and the amount that we can really maintain is going to be dependent on soil type as well. So the below 1-3% of organic matter can be considered as low in general. So another additional advantage you would get with organic matter, something that I am going to show again as well, that is the contaminant dilution. So you know that when we are adding compost to soil, we add large quantities of compost material, so these organic sources. So the one-third or one-fourth by volume, so and then mix with top 6 or 8 inches of soil. So when you are doing this much of addition and mixing it with topsoil, something, the immediate effect you would see that the contaminant dilution in soil. This example shows that this is from our Kansas City slide, site, and then the before and after compost addition, the total lead concentration on the y-axis, and the before is in red and the after is in green, and four different pots and four different field plots, and showing the before concentration ranging from about 289 to 186, and then the after addition of compost, we added compost about 28 kilograms per meter square, and try to mix it with topsoil, top 6 inches well. And then the dilution we observed was it brought down total lead concentration from 203 to about 114. This was about 50% reduction. The reduction varied, it's a field plot, the variability you could expect because of that, but in general we observed drastic effect of dilution. Another thing you would be getting is differences in growth between amended and non-amended plots. So this one is from our Tacoma site, and showing that the, I said this soil is very sandy, and this one is treated with tar group, and we also use dolomite to neutralize acidity because soil pH was low as well at this site. And the Tagro, little bit about Tagro. Tagro is a locally available product for gardeners, and it is made of 50% of Class A biosolid from that area, and 25% sodas and 25% of sand. So since the gardeners use this particular product for their gardening activities, so we also use that. As you can see, the control and the Tagro dolomite added plots, the growth differences were striking. So you could, because of this enhanced growth, further dilution of contaminants can be expected. So that's another advantage. This shows the what is going to happen to nutrient concentrations when we add compost. This example is showing Swiss chard lead versus lead in Swiss chard tissues versus available phosphorus in soil. So the this magenta pink ones are no compost-added soils, and the blue ones are compost-added soils, and the y-axis is Swiss chard lead concentration in microgram per kilogram dry weight basis, or ppb. So the malic extractable B, little bit about the x-axis, so malic 3 extractable P is in state of Kansas. We use to measure, this is the soil test method that we use to get an idea about available phosphorus to plant. So when you look at the no compost versus compost one, you can clearly see that addition of compost is significantly increasing the malic 3 extractable P levels. The levels we consider as actually excessive. So the when you look at these levels of malic extractable P and what is a Swiss chard lead, you could clearly see that the higher levels of malic 3 extractable P is helping plants to keep lead levels low. So next thing is another soil amendment that I want to talk a little bit about is biosolids. And I do know that people look at biosolids without knowing about it or not wanting to know about it in various different ways. So the biosolids, if you do have clean biosolids, something that we categorize as class A biosolid, those are nutrient-rich organic materials. I mean, all biosolids are nutrient-rich organic materials, but if it is clean, then you don't have to worry about other things. That's why I was focusing on clean biosolids. So biosolids in general are nutrient-rich organic materials resulting from the treatment of domestic sewage in treatment facility. So the as you know, that tested, those are tested, so and depending on the how they meet federal biosolid rule, then we categorize into different categories. Class A we consider as exceptional quality biosolids. So these type of clean biosolids can be applied as fertilizer and will definitely improve soil structure. So the very efficient use of organic nitrogen phosphorus by crops because of slow release throughout the growing season. So that's something that the if you are comparing inorganic fertilizers versus organic, the nutrient in organic matter. So you would see that organic compounds, you would see that they are slow releasing. So those are added advantages. In addition to that, some of these biosolids can contain the high levels of iron oxides. So these high levels of iron hydroxides can have impact on the adsorptive power that it's going to give the soil. So this particular example is looking at the soil cadmium soil solution cadmium concentrations and looking at adsorbed cadmium levels. And the red those data points are dealing with the biosolid itself, the ability of biosolid to adsorb cadmium. So you could see that the most of cadmium would be in adsorbed form if you are looking at biosolid itself. When you apply biosolid to soil, then you are diluting it so that the soil capacity is not going to be as high as biosolid alone. So as you can see in green data points that it has significant enhanced adsorptive capacity compared to soil non-amended with biosolid. So this is one example, one good example. You can select compost type that's going to give you additional benefits. So the compost types like going versus leafy vegetable, leafy compost versus going for something like high quality biosolid. And when we look at how these biosolid really enhancing the capacity of soil to reduce bioavailability of metals, this one is showing the relationship between the cadmium and iron. You can see that cadmium in this biosolid, as we observed using X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy, associated with iron. So this tight correlation between iron and cadmium and other metals are indicative that addition of biosolid to soils, you could enhance the metal adsorption capacity in soil. So likewise, this particular example from EPA, this is 2007 publication, addressing types of problems and the what are the soil amendments that we can use. So it is showing the toxicity caused by aluminum and the arsenic. Some of these toxicities are not really toxicities like directly like phytotoxicities, but we do know that some of these ones can be potentially toxic if we allow it to present in plant material more. So to reduce, depending on the exposure pathway or the adverse effect, the objective of adding these amendments could be different. So the second column is showing exposure pathways and adverse effect, and then the interactions that it's going to have, and then the solution. So this is a good example that you can look at, and then during my next presentation, I will be using research data showing the effect of different amendments on some common soil contaminants. So the next one we gardeners can do would be that the crop selection. So depending on the contaminant type and concentration, gardeners can easily do crop selection, decide whether to grow root crops, leafy vegetables, fruiting crops, etc. So the when we look at both common organic and inorganic contaminants, root crops tend to have shown to take up more contaminants compared to leafy or fruit-bearing crops. Again, I will be sharing these data so that this crop selection slide, what I had on crop selection slide would be clear. So as a summary, the soil amendments or BMPs, we do need to address soil quality issues. So till and add compost to mitigate compaction, add compost or biosolid to improve soil structure, mitigate compaction to provide nutrients, and to reduce bioavailability of contaminants over time. And then add lime or acidulating materials depending on pH to adjust pH to reduce bioavailability of contaminants, and then maintain optimum nutrient levels, and that is going to ensure that plants are not suffering from nutrient deficiencies. So as an additional effect, they providing high PE or optimal PE to reduce bioavailability of metals, and then also select suitable crop type. So with that, I'll open this for discussion.
Oh, great. Thanks, Ganga. Yeah, a number of questions have come in while you were speaking, so I think this is a good point to stop and try to address some of those. And then again, if a question comes up that you're going to address in the last part of your presentation, you can just mention that, and we can save any clarification for after that if we need to. We got a number of questions about soil screening levels and thresholds and what you would recommend, because in the beginning of your presentation you were talking about you want to assess whether who's going to be gardening, kids, adults, people with disabilities, et cetera. Do you have any advice on, you know, what screening levels or thresholds, you know, people would use for different contaminants, or how you go about assessing that?
Yeah. So I don't have like a clear answer for this question.
Yeah.
But I don't think any of us have clear answer to this question. But one thing that can be sure that depending on pathway, the pathway of concern, these levels that we need to worry about would be significantly different. For example, if you when it comes to kids, it's a completely different thing. But if you're thinking that you cannot minimize direct exposure, okay, then you do need to go with more stricter screening levels, or like the comfortable levels. But if you are gardening, if this is garden-oriented question, gardening-oriented question, there are things that we can do, gardeners can do to minimize direct exposure to soil. So I will be addressing some of those things while I am sharing research data. So covering pathways, there are general things that BMPs that the gardeners can do. But if it is, the concern is not direct exposure, indirect exposure from soil to plant to human. If they are concerned that plant would take it up, and then if we consume those plants, we would get impacted. Actually, the screening levels for most contaminants could be much higher than direct exposure, what we consider as safe level.
Right.
Right. That is because most contaminants do not move easily from soil to plant.
Right. Okay.
So I will try to give some numbers with my next presentation.
Okay.
But again, I mean, clear thing is if you are using 400 ppm, for example, for lead, we do have that number. That's the number we use as a number that should not exceed in children play areas, or
right.
sometimes called as residential soil lead limit. So my point is that number you can use it for direct exposure. But if your concern is gardening, it could be different depending on the crop you are gardening and depending on soil you are dealing with and all those other things.
Right, and I guess the point being that the exposure based on, you know, the gardening scenario isn't something that has been specifically modeled per se.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, talking about testing, this is a good question that came in. Someone wants to know where would they go to start getting their soil tested if they were interested? Like, what would they even do? Who would they talk to?
They can talk to extension agents if they have local extension agents, and then send their samples to state university soil testing laboratories to get their soil tested for agronomic parameters, as well as most, I mean, it is becoming more and more common that most soil testing laboratories do provide testing for at least lead.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way, and then the other way would be that sending to a private laboratory to get soil tested. Again, depending on where you go and how much you can spend, the level of testing can be different. And but to definitely soil urban gardens should consider testing their soils for agronomic parameters
mm-hmm.
and potential contaminants.
Okay. We've got a couple questions. People are wondering about how to measure bioavailability and if there is a way for, you know, people who want a garden to test for that on their soil.
Okay. So the bioavailability is a broader term, like I mentioned in my previous presentation. So if it is bioavailability to plants, so the best way would be use plants and see what's going to be end up in plants. If the bioavailability to human, I assume question is actually that. And then there are procedures, but it's not really offered through even university soil testing labs. That is, for lead and arsenic, we do have a test, bioavailability test, that try to mimic gastrointestinal dissolution procedure and then try to measure what's the fraction of lead or fraction of arsenic in soil that can be bioavailable. We call it bioaccessibility test. So as far as I know, most soil testing are not offering these tests currently, but at the same time, there's a lot of research effort going on by other researchers that looking at some common soil test methods and trying to see whether we can replace these gastrointestinal dissolution procedure or whether we can really predict what is going to be bioavailable by using a soil test method that we use for looking at available phosphorus or some other metals. So at the moment, answer is unless you have access to, you know, you're part of a research program, you would not be able to find laboratories that offer this test.
Okay. You mentioned best management practices in reducing exposure to soil that is known or may be known to be contaminated. One participant is curious about, using treated lumber to build their raised beds, and if there's what the concerns are around that, if there's any risks that people should be aware of?
Yeah, again, depending on what is the lumber treated with, and then most of the time, these contaminants, what you need to be worried about is not really grow something very close to treated lumber, okay? So depending on what it is, so the grow it away from that. So because I will be again sharing research data showing that the mobility of these some of these contaminants are low, so you wouldn't be seeing really it is influencing plant uptake. I haven't seen any research data. Particularly looking at something like that, but it's good to either like find untreated, and then if there's no option, try to use something else. If you are concerned, make sure that you are away from those type of materials.
Okay. Well, I think that's
about 6 to 12 inches away from that type of treated materials.
Okay. Well, I think that's a good segue into the last portion of your presentation. Again, we can come back to address any more questions that keep coming in. So why don't we go ahead, Ganga, and have you do part three, and then we'll open up for discussion again.
Thank you, Michelle. So. Part three of my presentation is gardening at brownfield sites. So I'm going to first give you a little bit about K-State gardening initiatives at brownfield sites project, little information about that. So the researchers at Kansas State University have been evaluating the uptake of contaminants by food crops grown on urban brownfield sites. The goal of this research is to enhance the capabilities of gardening initiatives to produce crops locally without concern about adverse health effects for the grower or the end consumer, basically to contribute to the meaningful revitalization of brownfield sites in a sustainable manner. So this research is made possible by a grant from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, specifically Brownfield Training Research and Technical Assistance Grant Program. And thus far, seven test sites established nationwide on brownfield sites slated for community gardening. So when we have a site, there we have a process that we are following, that the first thing we would do is try to establish site history. As I mentioned before, that this is mainly to narrow down what to test for. So we do know that we do need to test if it is for gardening. Definitely we do need to look at some agronomic parameters to find to understand what are the things we need to address. In addition to that, the soil contamination, so the contaminants, there's so many inorganic contaminants and organic contaminants, so we need to be able to narrow it down to know what to test for. So we collect soil samples and do these testing, agronomic and environmental, and after testing, based on both environmental and agronomic parameters, recommend BMPs and provide technical assistance. In addition to that, we also establish test plots following the scientific methods, and we do continuous monitoring of soil and produce samples in test plots for at least 2 years. And while we are actually working with a garden and garden community, we train and provide technical assistance to participating organizations throughout. So what I'm going to do is I will be using three example sites to share main research findings from this research that's been going on for more than 6 years now. So the first example site is from Kansas City, Missouri site, and size was about 42 meter by 37 meter. And the site was formerly occupied by four houses. The houses were demolished in the late 70s. And the the community was concerned about lead contamination, and then also they were concerned about the potential pesticide contamination, especially chlorine. The soil texture was silt loam, I mentioned before too. Clay content was about 21%. Initially, we screened the site in situ for trace elements using a handheld X-ray fluorescence spectrometer, and we found elevated lead levels in soil. I will talk about in a bit. And other potential contaminants we tested, others too, including arsenic and cadmium. Those were not elevated. So, like I said, since neighborhood community was worried about chlorine because of potential use of it as a pesticide for termite control in the past, so we tested for that. When we analyzed for chlorine, we found that chlorine concentration in these soils were non-detect. And while analyzing for chlorine, we found that all soil samples we tested initially contained detectable amounts of DDT and daughter product of DDT, which is DDE, in detectable concentration. But the levels were not high enough to be concerned. So the next slide is showing the soil lead distribution map. So total soil lead distribution map was generated using XRF, the X-ray fluorescence, handheld X-ray fluorescence, and GPS data. So the spatial distribution of total soil lead was highly heterogeneous, and as you can see, lead concentration ranged from 60 to about 350 milligrams per kilogram or ppm. We did a laboratory confirmation analysis, and we found that laboratory confirmation analysis was in good agreement with the XRF screening. This is a good example showing that heterogeneity of contaminant distribution is a major challenge in many of the urban brownfield sites that gardeners have to deal with. So this slide shows some selected soil properties or agronomic parameters, soil pH, plant available phosphorus, extractable potassium or available potassium, and available nitrogen measured as nitrate nitrogen and ammonium nitrogen. NH4 is standing for ammonium, and NO3 standing for nitrate there. And then the last column is organic matter as a percentage. So when we look at, we do know, we talk about it, lead is relatively unavailable to plants when the soil pH is neutral or above 6.5. When we look at the soil pH at the Washington Wheatley site or the our Kansas City site, it was above 7 or close to that, so we thought that no action was required related to soil pH. Do know that lead is also less available when available soil phosphorus concentrations are high. P concentration, when we are looking at these malic 3P or malic extractable P, which is giving us idea about plant available P, this particular site, the levels were either very high or excessive. So we didn't think that we do need to add any phosphorus fertilizers, at least in this season. And the nitrate and ammonium levels indicated that definitely this site can use some nitrogen, and extractable potassium levels were okay. And then the organic matter content, in for most part, we didn't consider as very low, but there were areas in the garden that can definitely use some organic matter. So depending on these soil test values as a soil amendments, adding organic matter to soil to reduce both lead and minimize DDT availability to plant, although it's not a concern, was the management practices we thought as suitable for this site. So this shows we had test plots in at this site in 2009 and 2010, and this is showing test plots in 2010. And the treatments we used at this site, no compost and compost at about 25 kilograms per meter square. And three types of crops with different growth and uptake characteristics were used. And Swiss chard representing leafy vegetable, carrot representing root crops, tomato representing fruit crop. So after harvesting, produce samples were divided into two portions and subjected to two cleaning procedures. One is thorough cleaning, laboratory cleaning, and the second procedure was kitchen-style cleaning. So laboratory cleaning was done by rinsing the produce with deionized water, followed by detergent mix solution, followed by deionized water. This method was developed to remove all adhering soil dust particles from produce surfaces. So kitchen-style cleaning was done using only tap water to mimic the kitchen type of washing procedure in a home kitchen. However, in during kitchen cleaning, we made sure that we removed all visible soil particles from the produce. So the slide I showed without numbers during my previous presentation. This is the immediate effect of compost addition, that is contaminant dilution through compost addition. So when we are looking at over here, look at the total soil lead concentration prior to compost addition and after compost addition. So the prior to compost addition, average total soil lead concentration is about 246, and then after compost addition, it was 146. So this is a direct, immediate effect that's going to get through addition of compost in addition to getting nutrients and improving soil quality parameters. So the next slide shows lead concentration in Swiss chard. First, let me explain what is the Codex NCL. So the World Health Organization and Food and Agriculture Organization, I'm going to refer to as WHO and FAO, has set the standards for food crop concentration of lead. And these standards are derived on the assumption that 100% of lead present in produce is bioavailable. So these safe limits are overly protective. So moreover, these limits assume lifelong consumption and all vegetables of this type. So I just gave this information for you to understand about this limit. The limit for lead in leafy vegetables is about 5 ppm or 5 milligrams per kilogram dry weight basis. So the first thing when we look at a little bit about this graph, so we do have compost and no compost on the x-axis, and the lead concentration in Swiss chard in milligrams per kilogram dry weight basis on y-axis. So the first, these are averages of four plots because we had four blocks repeating the same treatment. So the first thing is lead concentration in Swiss chard were below FAO WHO limit, regardless the treatment. So the soil lead concentrations in the no compost in these plots range from 128 to about 348, and then the compost added ones range from 101 to 256 milligrams per kilogram. And then the lab clean, results from lab clean versus kitchen clean. Lab clean is in red and kitchen clean in blue. So what you can see that the when you compare compost and no compost, the reduction due to compost addition to lead concentration in tissues was about 59%. The cleaning method also significant. The lab cleaning was able to remove nearly 67% of the lead concentration in plant tissue, indicating that majority of lead that we observed in kitchen clean samples actually due to deposited dust or the surface contamination. So this slide shows lead concentration in tomatoes. So the first thing, again, I do have Codex NCL limits for tomato, and then it is about 1.6 milligrams per kilogram dry weight basis. And main thing is concentration of lead in tomatoes were very little. Actually, we had very difficult time of measuring those accurately. So here in this particular, tomatoes, we think that it is because the concentrations were very low, so the compost wasn't able to really make a difference in this case. Anyway, we did not see any effect of compost addition on tomato, concentration of lead in tomato. However, we observed that the proper cleaning helped to further reduce lead exposure through tomato consumption. The lab cleaning was able to reduce lead concentration in tomato tissues by 61 to 78%. This slide shows lead concentration in carrot. Lead concentration in carrots were below or at the minimum, actually at the maximum allowable limits of lead established by the Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Health Organization. So the cleaning methods did not affect lead concentration in carrot, and this is actually not surprising because research has shown, research done by research scientists at USDA and USEPA collaboratively has clearly shown that the lead accumulation is in xylem of carrot. So you wouldn't be seeing the peeling or the thorough cleaning really impacting lead concentration. The compost addition, however, we did observe about 20% reduction in lead concentration in carrot. So I'm moving to second example site that was in Tacoma, Washington. The Tacoma site had mildly to moderate the elevated levels of lead and arsenic. Arsenic concentrations range from 17 to, when we look at whole site, concentration range from 17 to 162 milligrams per kilogram, and lead concentration range from 17 to 427. The soil texture was sandy loam, dominated by sand, size fraction. Again, one thing that you can see, you may not be able to see, but from the range you can see that the heterogeneity of contaminant distribution or the variability of contaminant distribution. So the Tacoma, Washington community gardeners, actually, they use raised beds due to state regulations. So the state regulations require them to not to grow in ground if the arsenic concentration is greater than 20 or the lead concentration greater than 250. So that's what this slide is showing. So this one is showing test plots in Tacoma, Washington in 2010. So we established, as you can see, in ground test plots, soil had, when we did the agronomic or the soil testing to find out the available nutrient concentration. We found low to medium available nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium in soil. So depending on soil texture and the agronomic parameters, we decided to use, soil pH was low. It was actually below 4.5 initially, so we decided to use compost and together with dolomite. So the compost rate we used was about 28 kilograms per meter square. And the compost type was locally available class A biosolid. I mentioned this before. It's a biosolid mix with sand and sawdust and known as local as Tagro. We use three types of crops, lettuce representing leafy vegetables, carrot representing root crops, and tomato representing fruiting vegetables. So I showed this before too, so the reason I have this slide again is not only to show the growth differences in this should be dolomite and Tagro added versus control plots, but also to a little bit talk about, since I'm not going to share lead results, that is because lead uptake pattern by tested vegetable types are similar. It followed highest lead concentration was in root crop and followed by leafy and fruiting. And then when we look at leafy and fruit crops, the lead concentrations were below NCL established by FAO and WHO. So the results were similar to what I shared for Kansas City site. I'm going to show arsenic data. The first one is showing arsenic in lettuce tissue. And the lead up, I'm not going to show lead results. Okay, so here, as you can see, the arsenic concentration in lettuce were very low. And unlike for lead, there are no established maximum contaminant limit for arsenic in vegetables. So we use a conservative maximum level of 1,800 micrograms per kilogram dry weight basis. We estimated this number using the EPA's inorganic arsenic daily reference dose. You can look at that reference to see what it is, and then I can explain if you are interested in how we did the calculation. So the another thing that was clear, even though the arsenic in the two samples were low, we did see significant impact of Tagrodolomite amendment on arsenic concentration in lettuce. It reduced arsenic concentration further. So arsenic in tomatoes here, this shows again, the arsenic concentrations were very, very small in tomato. Here, we are not even showing the limit we established or calculated. Soil arsenic concentration, excuse me, range from 37 to about 97. And in 2011, the plots, and then the because of the Tagro amendment, the 2011, it ranged from 26 to 76. So the bottom line, again, the arsenic concentration in tomatoes were very low, and lower than the arsenic concentration observed in leaf vegetable, the lettuce in this case. This shows arsenic in carrots. So the arsenic in carrots, unlike for lead, arsenic concentration we observed were below the conservatively estimated maximum limit. We did not see effect of soil amendments for carrots. This takes us to the third example, that is our test sites in Indianapolis, Indiana. So this site had elevated levels of lead. The concentration ranged from 437 to about 513. Actually, this level is where we had the test plot. And then the arsenic concentration ranged from about 23 to 84. The pHs, this is sum of total, those 16 pHs EPA considered as concern. So those range from 23 to 50 milligrams per kilogram. So this is showing the 2011 pictures from 2011. We did continue this study up to 2012, and then up to really 2013 not without plants. So the amendments we used for this site was four compost types. Those four compost types we used were leafy compost, mushroom compost, composted biosolid, and non-composted biosolid. So here we observed similar patterns of arsenic uptake and lead. So the because of that, I'm not going to show those data, and I'm going to show only pHs in soil and vegetables. This is from 2011. And these 16 pHs in the EPA's list are listed there, and then for your information, first column shows the number of rings in these pHs or polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and then the range in test plots, the soil concentration is in the third column, and the concentration in tomato and carrot on the last column. So the regardless of the treatment, the concentration of all 16 USEPA priority pHs measured in the vegetable were non-detectable. So the why I have less than 0.01 or less than 0.04 is to show that that was our detection limit. So the data are not shown here, but another thing I should mention, the soil data showed that the biodegradation of soil pHs was enhanced by compost addition, and this effect was most prominent for 2 to 3 ring pHs than 4 to 6 ring pHs, and that makes sense because 4 to 6 ring pHs have low volatility, slower degradation rate, so well the soil colloids so stay longer in soil. So here, from this point onward, I'm using some additional slides to actually show some data from other researchers. And this particular slide is showing plant uptake of organic contaminant. And particularly, this is also another study done by looking at plant uptake of pHs. So this is again showing the carrot peel versus carrot core, and showing that the pHs tend to accumulate in the peel. And I didn't mention, we did see that similar type of effect for arsenic as well. We did observe the peeled arsenic to have peel arsenic had less arsenic concentration in cat. So I don't have those here, but this is just an example. The study is done using persistent organic contaminants known as POPs or POPs. Show that root and stems accumulate very low amount of pHs, PCB, DDT, like in, those are examples for POPs. And then after more than, I actually last week contacted a leading research scientist in scientists at Connecticut Ag Experimental Station. They have conducted more than 2 decades of experiments to look at how efficiently phytoextract POPs, so persistent organic contaminants. And then the he said that they are having hard time of actually finding way to effectively remove these contaminants from soil, meaning that the plant uptake is very low. This is from a study examining a transfer of TCE, trichloroethylene, by fruits and vegetables growing in communities surrounding Hill Air Force Base in northern Utah, dealing with TCE contaminated groundwater. Like I mentioned before, fruit trees live longer and they are deep-rooted, so important to look at. They also looked at vegetables such as tomatoes and carrots, although there is less chance of getting affected. So TC, the bottom line, when we look at this one, TC concentration observed in foods were below the method detection limit for 2002 and 2003. They only observed detected TC levels in foods in 2001. They were unsure about why they observed detectable level, the levels of TCE, whether it is why they did not observe that in 2002 and 2003, whether that is because of improved analytical techniques that they use in the later years. So the detectable levels of TCE was found in three core samples in 2001, 2002, and 2003. So showing that there can be uptake and then the uptake to fruit, but ending up in fruit is going to be very small. So this one is showing we tried to find a site contaminated with chromium, but we were not able to find a site contaminated with chromium. And then I contacted some other colleagues and researchers actually working on in this area for so long. And then again, we I was not able to find very recent data. This one is actually showing data, some research done in, but in very good way, done in 1990s. Still, but observed is still stands. So this is showing the soil chromium concentration used in this study actually exceeded 1%. And when we are looking at plant tissue chromium concentration, as you can see, plant tissue concentration of chromium was low and ranging from about 1.552 all the way down to 0.29 milligrams per kilogram. And then they also actually based on titanium concentration in soil and plant tissue, they used that to use as a measure to calculate soil inclusion. They concluded that effect of soil entrapment is significantly affecting the apparent plant concentration of chromium. So the corrected chromium concentration in some time, in most cases, actually below what they observed, so they could not really say anything about what the corrected chromium concentration would be because they did not measure, they didn't have way to directly do that estimation. But the conclusion was, studies done later too, the conclusion was that the contribution is significant. So that is something that need to be considered. So this slide I am using to show that this is the only slide I'm using. This is again related to one question that someone asked, participant asked, that whether we can test the human available contaminant level. So this is the test that I was talking about. There's in vitro, there are several in vitro methods that we can use to test the gastrointestinal dissolution of soil, lead and arsenic. And depending on, so you do need to look at what's the pH that these methods are using. And you, scientists established that looking at pH 2.5 makes sense, although EPA prefer to use these extraction procedures at pH 1.5. So this particular method that we use, known as physiologically based extraction test, or acronym is PBAT. So you can see that percentage of bioaccessible lead, this is from our Kansas City garden test plots. And this is showing, we did this test for two fractions, the whole soil. And usually this method is asking requires you to use less than 250 micrometer fraction. So if we focus on less than 250 micrometer fraction and look at the no compost and compost, and looking at 16 days after adding compost, that is at planting, and 105 days after adding compost at harvesting. So you can see that here we I show the first column shows the bioaccessible lead in milligrams per kilogram, and then the column right next to that for each time period shows the percent bioaccessible lead. So the bioaccessible lead as a percentage of soil total lead. So as you can see that the bioaccessibility of lead in these soils were very low. In this particular site, it was below 15%. And in some cases, it was below actually 10%. So we did see the effect of compost addition on percent bioaccessibility. So the reason we look at percent bioaccessibility, when you are looking at bioaccessible lead, you cannot really say something clearly, because you can have we do have dilution effect due to compost addition. So because of that, we may see reduced bioavailability. Because of that, we actually focus on looking at percent bioaccessible lead. So we are normalizing for total lead concentration in soil when we are looking at it. So when you are looking at and focusing on percent bioaccessible lead at 16 days after adding compost and 105 days after adding compost, you can see that the reduction is about going from 5.6 to 3.9 or 1 to 3.9. So showing us there's a significant reduction. There can be significant reduction of bioaccessibility due to compost addition. So this is actually separate from dilution effect, indicating that something in compost, most likely phosphorus, is reducing bioaccessibility. So as a summary, the main thing, the soil, plant, human, this pathway seems to be non-significant. This is not only from our studies, but also from studies done by other researchers. So in general, concentration of contaminants in above ground biomass are low. So if you look at the always you can see a pattern that root crops going to be affected more, and then leafy, and then followed by footing crops. So as I said, root crops will be affected by elevated levels of lead as well as some persistent organic contaminants in soils. So that's something to watch for, and then decide based on contaminant level what to grow. The compost or biosolid addition reduced contaminant uptake as well as bioaccessibility of contaminant through dilution as well as improved binding capacity of soils. Thorough cleaning of vegetables further reduced the potential of transferring of soil contaminants to human via vegetable consumption. So that was clear, and we did see it repeatedly throughout our experiment. So use clean soil compost raised bed or containers to grow root crops if you do have lead contamination, or if you do have contamination due to persistent organic contaminants. I'm focusing more on persistent organic contaminants and paying more attention to that. That is because, unlike inorganic contaminants, organic contaminants tend to break down, and what we will see in soil mostly remaining are persistent organic contaminants. So if you have that kind of situation, that would be something that you need to grow certain crops in clean soil low compost raised bed. So follow BMPs to minimize soil to human, especially the contaminated soil ingestion pathway. So like I said, use covered pathways and many other things that we can do to minimize. And then the bioaccessibility of lead and arsenic. And also using different extracting procedures, when we look at some persistent organic chemicals too, it is clear that the bioaccessibilities of these contaminants are very low. And detailed chemical analysis or the in vitro or lab chemical extractions be done suggested that they are strongly bound and therefore not available. With that, I would like to thank graduate students involved in these experiments, Chami Attanayaka, Philip Diffoul, Janelle, Ashley, and Jay, and my co-PI, Dr. Sabine Martin, and other investigators associated with this project. They are listed over there. And then the colleagues and collaborators from various places, mainly Dr. Rufus Cheney, Dr. Kirk Sheckel, Dr. Nick Buster, Dr. Sally Brown, and Dr. Jason White from Connecticut Ag Experimental Station. With that, I'll open again stage for questions.
Okay, great. Thanks, Ganga. I guess we have a few minutes left, and there's a number of questions, so we're going to select a couple here. You had mentioned that arsenic and lead can be strongly bound, and this participant wants to know if that's true. You know, what can you say about the bioaccessibility for direct contact with the soil if there's elevated concentrations of these contaminants?
In most cases, when we look at bioaccessibility use, this mimic gastrointestinal dissolution procedure, we observe that bioaccessibility is to be very low. For lead, when we look at all our sites, it range from, we had a site which had the highest bioavailability, close to 30, and then in most cases, we had bioaccessibility of lead lower than 15. So direct, if there's the direct ingestion, that tells us that the bioaccessibility will be very low. So we should not consider it as like totally bioavailable or even EPA default the bioavailability, relative bioavailability value they use. And then the arsenic was also the same. The arsenic bioaccessibilities we observed in the sites contaminated with arsenic, the bioaccessibilities were less than 10 or 15. Did
okay.
I answer the question?
I think so. I think you had mentioned that concentration of some contaminants can decrease year to year, and I guess someone wants to know, I mean, is that occurring, you know, with gardening practice, and would it be considered a form of bioremediation?
Good question. So the pHs, the polycyclic aromatic, so you wouldn't see degradation for inorganic contaminants. Okay, they are going to stay in soil unless
right.
you dilute soil or remove soil or mix soils with clean soils. You wouldn't see any reduction. You should not see. But with organic contaminants, you would see, especially the organic contaminants that are going to be degraded easily. So when we look at those 16 pHs, during those years we work at that site, we observed that 2 to 3 ring pHs, actually, there was significant reduction, but not the 5 or 6 ring ones.
Mm-hmm.
So the some organic contaminants are going to persist in soil, but the contaminants that persist in soil tend to be less bioavailable because they persist in soil because they are highly zoomed.
Okay.
Okay. And then some tend to degrade. So adding organic matter and doing doing gardening activities, something you would do something you would unintentionally achieve is degradation of some of those organic contaminants.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe we can take one more question before we turn things back over to Jean Ballant. So this person wants to know that when you're considering redeveloping in an area that you know is historically an industrial area and you want to do testing, How far below the ground surface is it recommended to test for the contaminants?
Again, the gardening is the objective, that you may not want to go below 8 to 12 inches. Mm-hmm. So most of the sites we dealt with, we went we took two sets of samples, 0 to 6 and 6 to 12 inches. So we are talking about 30 centimeters, about that deep.
Okay, well,
it depends on your objective, and it depends on whether you have resources and what you are looking for and what your concern is.
Right. Right. No, that totally makes sense. Well, I want to thank you, Ganga, for a very interesting presentation. We've definitely have gotten a lot of interest from our audience, and I know Jean can recap with us a little bit of the level of participation we had. But I really appreciate you taking the time speaking with us today, and look forward to talking about this subject with you more in the future, because there's a lot more work that we can do. So thank you, Ganga.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Excellent. We're going to go ahead and walk our audience through just a few final reminders before we close things out today. I do want to thank the nearly 200 individuals who were able to join us from all over the world, actually. A number of international participants also signed in and joined us for today's session. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that you'll join us for future Clue In webinars. If you're interested, you can certainly follow us on popular social and professional networking sites or sign up for one of our numerous free newsletters or RSS feeds available on the Clue In website. For those of you looking to produce training records, we do have an automated lookup system that we've included on Clue In. If you go to the following URL, you can actually enter in your own email address, and we'll send you an automated table that will contain a list of each of the webinars that you've attended and checked in live. It doesn't include the ones you may have replayed from our recorded page, but we're working to incorporate that feature soon. So for those of you, again, trying to keep records of the webinars you attend, you might find this training lookup system to be helpful. I will ask if you can, those of you who'd like to download copies of the presentation materials or take a look at some of the other resources that were discussed, you can find those on the resources page. That's also available on the middle right of your screen under related URLs. If you are watching the recorded version of this webinar, those links are still active, so feel free to click on them, press the Browse To button, that'll open it up locally, including our urban gardening page that we have posted on Clue In, as Michelle highlighted earlier. I will also ask our participants to take a brief moment and fill out a short online feedback form. I do read each and every one of those replies, and it'll give you a chance to let us know what you thought, both of the content and technical material that was covered, as well as the format that we use for today's live delivery. If you shared the line with multiple people, each person can actually hop on and fill out their own feedback form. And it's still active and available under related URLs, so if, again, you're watching the recorded version, you can still click that link and fill out the feedback form after the live delivery. If you are trying to document your participation for CEUs or PEHs, we don't necessarily issue training certificates for each class. However, if you fill out the feedback form, there is a box that you can check. It's circled in red. As long as your email address is correct and that box is checked, we will send you an automated email that confirms you submitted feedback after the live delivery. Usually, our participants are able to earn credit or document their attendance using that type of confirmation email, along with either a copy of the slides or a printout of the seminar homepage. But again, if you need additional assistance documenting your attendance, feel free to reach out to me directly via email. Again, a great big thank you to our presenter who was able to join us today, as well as my co-moderator, Michelle Mahoney, and again, the nearly 200 individuals who join us from around the world. We hope that you'll join us on a future Clue In seminar. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.